Hello and welcome to the Healthy Pregnancy Revolution. My name is Stephanie Wilson. I'm your host here with Sarah Thompson. She is the author of Functional Maternity, the first and only book to highlight the role of functional medicine and nutrition, play, and maternal health, pregnancy, and childbirth outcomes. Sarah is a leading expert in the field of functional medicine and maternity and pregnancy care. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi, Stephanie. I'm good.
So what would you consider is the most important thing a woman can do before conception for a healthy pregnancy, a healthy baby, and a healthy postpartum experience?
So the preparation, we do a lot of work here in the clinic. One of my big pushes is to help women have better birth outcomes. And few people realize the importance of preconception health and nutrition and its effect on not just conception, but how their pregnancy and their childbirth unfolds. And so when we're looking at what are the best things a mother can do when preparing for conception and pregnancy and childbirth, two of the big ones are going to be obviously nutrition, right? I wrote an entire book on nutrition and pregnancy, right? And how it affects the biochemistry and the physiology. Making sure that the nutritional stores of the body are where they need to be coming into pregnancy is going to make the pregnancy experience so much more enjoyable, right? If somebody comes in with a nutritional deficiency, it's going to be really hard, if not impossible, to correct throughout pregnancy. And they may struggle and they may have more complications. One of the things that we can look at to help determine, like, do we have nutritional components that might affect pregnancy outcomes is by looking at the menstrual cycle itself. The menstrual cycle is a key, right, to understanding the hormones of the body, and everything with pregnancy is hormonally based. And if a woman's menstrual cycles are irregular, if we have heavy menstrual periods, if we have light menstrual periods, if we're spotting prior to a full period, all of these things can be signs and symptoms of minute changes, big changes in nutrition and hormone function that could play into the pregnancy experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I love that. Your period is already a window into what you can expect, even yes. If it's a couple months, or because isn't it 3 months out? If you get pregnant within that 3 month window, that's hard to change, right? You want those 3 months to really change the quality of the egg and your hormones.
Yeah. And maybe even longer. If somebody has weak eggs, sad eggs is what I call them. Maybe the eggs
sad are eggs. Like
sad eggs is what I call them. they're just sad. They just need a hug is what they need. It can take a full 9 months to hug those eggs enough.
Really?
That they are 100% healthy.
Yeah. What would you do in those 9 months? What would you focus on? What would be the most important thing?
Yeah, the most important things that kind of go into, and when we're looking at the ovary and how the ovary functions, I think we're all aware, we're all born with all the eggs we're ever going to have, right? These eggs kind of are suspended in a primordial goo, and this primordial goo is rich in antioxidants. These antioxidants are primarily things like CoQ10, vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and they help to reduce oxidative stress within the ovary. Now, oxidative stress is a term we use in functional medicine that basically is inflammation at a cellular level. Now, some of that inflammation is day-to-day inflammation. So oxidative stress is something we all accumulate every single day, just being alive, breathing in air, burning calories. We produce pollution. This pollution is called oxidative stress. When we go to sleep at night, our body cleans out that oxidative stress. One of the reasons we sleep is so that we can turn off the engine so we can clean it out. You can't reach into a car engine and clean it while it's running. You can't do the same thing to your cells. So maintaining this nice oxidative balance within the ovary helps to keep those primordial eggs healthy. Other things that are happening in this lovely little primordial goo phase is an accumulation of different nutrients that are going to fuel not only the development of that egg to an ovulatory phase, but also be part of the initial embryonic development. So when an embryo comes together with the sperm and the eggs bring nutrients. And these nutrients are the fuel for embryonic development. So big things are going to be your B vitamins, folate, B12, B6, pantothenic acid, riboflavin. There's a whole bunch of different B vitamins that go into metabolism, right? And metabolism is very big. You're doubling cells. You're making lots of mitochondria. You're doing a lot of work at an embryonic level that requires these different vitamins and minerals. And a mother can't give those to her baby until that placenta is fully developed. So whatever comes in with that embryo is what's going to stimulate that embryonic development. And what comes with that embryo is accumulated months before ovulation even occurs. So those are important ones. Zinc is another important nutrient that we see being a primary nutrient of focus in the preconception phase. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have seen these videos, but they're really fascinating. And I love to kind of point people in the direction. But if you go and Google IVF zinc firework, you'll find these little videos of the tubes where they're introducing the sperm and the egg. And there's a literal firework that occurs. There's a flash of light. How amazing is that?
Oh my gosh, it just gave me chills. Right? That's incredible.
There's a literal spark of life. And this spark of life is catalyzed by a zinc reaction. And what they found in these studies was that the egg and the sperm that had the least amount of zinc had the weakest spark. And these connections didn't become embryos. The brighter the spark, the more likely that embryo was to transfer and survive during an IVF transfer.
Wow.
Throughout that, what we learned really was, A, zinc is essential for that initial embryonic development. And it's a very common nutritional deficiency that I see in practice. So for a lot of my patients who've had recurrent miscarriages or conception issues, it's one of the first things that we look at is functional zinc values between the woman and the man. Right? We need it on both sides. 40% of pregnancy-related complications, such as miscarriage, placental dysfunction, are male fertility factor. This is a two-person deal. It's not just women at play here. So we have to also, if we're looking at preconception health, not just focus on the carrier. We have to focus on both parties, the provider of the egg and the provider of the sperm, because they are both playing into pregnancy outcomes.
How long does it take a woman who's deficient in zinc to really build that up?
Usually a couple of months. Nutrition therapy takes time. Okay. Yeah, so if we have people who are showing signs of some of these nutritional deficiencies, we will recommend 3 months of nutrition therapy and then retest levels to see where we're at.
Okay.
Sometimes it takes a full year.
And that's where you say that potentially 9 months comes in play that you really want.
Yeah. And when we're looking at like the primordial eggs and their journey through the ovary towards ovulation, it's about a 9 month journey from the first time they start to get stimulated towards ovulation.
Okay. I didn't know that. I thought it was about 3 months. That's what I was referring to. Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So at that 9 month mark, is that where you want to have all of your levels, your stores, as you said? Do you want to have those ready to go 9 months even before conception? Is that how far in advance we should be prepared? Or is it, you still have time to build up that egg in those?
There's still time to build up that egg. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We just kind of give the caveat sometimes when we're working with people who have like things like low AMH levels, high FSH levels, and things where they've been told they have low ovarian reserve, which sometimes just means sad eggs. Right. Sometimes it means low count, and sometimes it means eggs that just are slightly malnourished or a little high on the oxidative stress side. I give them a caveat, like I give them a warning, like this might take us a full year because they're sad. For somebody who doesn't have those sorts of complications, then 3 month window of boost up your nutrition. Let's focus on the things you're going to need for embryonic development and the first trimester to get you through that. That's usually ample.
Mm-hmm. With the end in mind, what can a woman do even before conception to positively affect her postpartum experience? I'm sure a lot of this you're talking about nutritional stores, and I think that is huge going into pregnancy for the postpartum period. Could you elaborate on that?
It absolutely is. Yeah. So I have a saying in practice that everything in pregnancy, including preconception, is preparing for preparing. So just when you think you're on top of it, you're not on top of it because you got to prepare for the next phase of pregnancy. Yep. And in my practice, we consider pregnancy a year preconception through a year postpartum. So when I say pregnancy support, that's what we're talking about. And everything in pregnancy builds upon itself. And so everything is like a stair step. And we have these little thresholds and we have these things that we have to accomplish in the maternal physiology for the next step to be successful. So mm-hmm. let's take iron, for example. Let's just use this. So we see in studies that ferritin levels are very important throughout pregnancy, right? Everybody, I'm sure, mm-hmm. has been or heard about anemia in pregnancy, iron, take extra iron, all these different things. But studies show that preconception ferritin levels actually are very predictive of postpartum anemia. It has to do with the changes in iron metabolism that occur throughout pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So if we look at, you know, say preconception through the first trimester to begin with, when you go into the first trimester, your iron absorption levels tank because your body doesn't want right. iron at this point. You should have stored enough ferritin preconception to get you through the first trimester where your body doesn't want to absorb iron and it doesn't want to store ferritin. You're living off your ferritin reserves.
Wow.
Pretty interesting, right?
It is so interesting. I didn't know this.
In the second trimester, we see that iron absorption starts to increase again. Okay. That's when we start to see that you're doubling your blood volume. Now, it's actually a 35% increase in red blood cells and a 50% increase in plasma, which is the fluid aspect of the blood. But we see that iron absorption starts to increase through that time frame. And in the second trimester, a woman is rebuilding her ferritin stores in order to make the red blood cells she needs and to prepare for third trimester. So again, we're preparing for the next phase of preparing.
Right.
So when there's a threshold, and I think it's usually about 30, 32 weeks for most people, but we see that iron metabolism shifts again. And even though iron absorption is the highest it will ever be mid-third trimester, very little, if any, of that iron goes to the mother. Mm-hmm. She should have rebuilt her ferritin stores so that in the third trimester, she can break down her ferritin stores just like she did in the first trimester. Most of that iron goes to baby because baby now has to make its ferritin reserves to get through the fourth trimester or those 3 months postpartum when they can't absorb iron out of breast milk or formula. So we see that women who kind of come into that third trimester with low ferritin levels, not only do they struggle through the third trimester because they still have to make red blood cells for themselves and provide iron for their growing baby, mm-hmm. but then in the fourth trimester or that postpartum phase, mm-hmm. they really struggle because childbirth, we lose blood. Even if it's a beautiful mm-hmm. natural vaginal delivery, you're still going to lose blood, mm-hmm. right? If we factor in a surgical delivery is you lose more blood than you do with a vaginal birth, right? So whatever birth you go through, there's an element of blood loss that your body mm-hmm. has to recover from. And part of storing that ferritin through the third trimester and holding it, right? You have to have enough that you can recover from mm-hmm. that blood loss, right? So if you start off pregnancy already slightly anemic with low ferritin reserves, you are going to struggle postpartum mm-hmm. in recovering your blood volume, right? Which can take 12 weeks to do, right?
That's so amazing.
So when yeah. we talk about this preconception nutrition, it is extremely important mm-hmm. for a successful pregnancy and recovery from that one year postpartum. There's a lot of things that happen in pregnancy that you have to recover from in that postpartum phase. That's just one of them, right? The blood demand and this iron component and the blood loss of childbirth. There's also mm-hmm. hormonal things you have to recover from as well.
Okay, so circling back around to the nutrition, how do you believe nutrition affects a woman's experience of pregnancy, of delivery, and postpartum? You're talking about hormones, of course, yeah. our food is going to change.
Yeah, and you know, I believe in this so much that I wrote a book on it because it is information that is out there, yet nobody really talks about how mm-hmm. nutrition affects the maternal physiology. We talk a lot about nutrition in the fetal development, right? We kind of touched mm-hmm. on that a little bit with the embryonic development, and it is extremely important. We all want happy, healthy, beautiful babies that are going to be robust, right? And grow the way they're supposed to. But we don't want that at the expense of the mother if we can help it.
Right.
So anything we can do to support that maternal physiology not only gives us that healthy baby outcome, but also gives us a healthy mom outcome, mm-hmm. because we're also birthing mothers, mm-hmm. right? And most people don't realize that nutrition affects a lot of the pregnancy and specifically the childbirth outcomes. There are, I don't know, dozens upon dozens of studies that link different nutritional deficiencies and nutritional components to a wide variety of pregnancy complications. Preeclampsia, for example, is a placental dysfunction issue, right? But we see that certain vitamins and minerals, phytonutrients, antioxidants, we see these being deficient in preeclampsia cases. And there's two phases of placental development. There's the embryonic phase, right? Which is those initial like 10 days to 10 weeks of placental development, which is highly dependent on preconception nutrition. And then there's the second phase of placental development, which happens in the second trimester through the third trimester, where a lot of what a mother consumes helps to facilitate the development and the health of that placenta. So we can see preeclampsia kind of popping up on either side of that nutritional front. So we see things like vitamin D being a big one. Vitamin D deficiency is associated with higher risks of preeclampsia. Yet nobody really tests vitamin D throughout pregnancy.
Right?
Having a good vitamin D level preconception is very important because we see that the demand for vitamin D in pregnancy is extremely high. And unfortunately, there's no good study that says, oh yes, there's a twofold demand for vitamin D or whatever it is. The most recent studies have shown that it takes about 4,000 international units of vitamin D to maintain serum vitamin D levels in pregnancy, which is why a lot of organizations are pushing for prenatals and different supplements to provide 4,000 international units instead of the RDA 600.
It's a big difference.
That's a big difference, right? And what we see is that vitamin D is important for the production of hormones. Okay. If we go into biochemistry, vitamin D is a hormone. It's not really a vitamin, like we consider vitamins. It's in the same family of hormones that you find progesterone, estrogen, cortisol, these hormones of pregnancy. And interestingly, vitamin D regulates the production of these hormones. And we see that there is an increase in vitamin D receptors in the placenta and uterine tissues throughout pregnancy. And they help to produce things like progesterone. They help to produce a lot of other hormones and different enzymes and different things within the placenta. So that's just one of the nutrient things. If we're looking at labor and delivery, one of the interesting things, if we pull back into vitamin D, and again, there's so many different nutrient connections. Again, I wrote an entire book on it. So I wish I could just read off the book to you guys today, because there is a ton of connections. With vitamin D, we see that women who are vitamin D deficient tend to have more painful labors. We see that there is a higher risk of cesarean delivery. There's a lot of complications that we see associated with vitamin D deficiency, depression, postpartum depression, and prenatal depression.
And I'm sure you would advise it's better that we get out into the sun, even though there is nutritional supplements for it, or there are foods that we should eat over supplementation.
Yeah. And it depends, right? Depends on where you live. Everybody needs the exact same diet. Everybody needs the exact same supplements type of person, because we all live in different areas of the world. I work with patients literally all over the world. And when I have a patient who lives in the Florida Keys versus a patient who lives in Iceland, right? We're going to look at their nutrition actually quite different, even though they both eat a lot of fish and different things like that. A lot of it has to do with where they live in the world. And we see that people who live above the 37th parallel, which is a latitudinal line that runs about through the middle of the United States, anybody who lives above that tends to be vitamin D deficient. And people who live at altitude tend to be vitamin D deficient. Now, why?
Wow.
Because we convert cholesterol in our blood, or in our skin, is converted by the ultraviolet rays of the sun to vitamin D. But you have to have those correct types of UV rays. And the higher you get in latitudinal line on the earth, we get a different angle of sunlight.
Yeah. Okay.
And we don't get as much of the correct types of UV rays for our skin to make vitamin D. So we're limited on the amount of time during a season that we can make vitamin D. And this is a natural biological process. If you look at biology and we look at seasonality, what you see is people tend to make a bunch of vitamin D in the sun during the summer months. But what's cool about vitamin D is your body stores it and then breaks it down and uses it as it should, right? That's the cyclical, if you look at, you know, the seasons and the sunlight, that would be a normal thing. You should be able to sit in the sun, right? And live outside in the sun all season and make enough vitamin D. But let's pull in society. How many of us are out in the sun all day long every day? Not much. And those who are usually putting on sunscreen.
Yeah.
Right? We don't want to get burned. I don't want to get burned. I got sunburned this weekend. It wasn't fun. So there are some things playing against us in a modern society and the way we live, as well as where we live on the earth. So some people do need to supplement with vitamin D. And I am a big test, don't guess person, because again, I have found people who they don't need supplementation. They do just fine being in the sun and eating fish and mushrooms, right? And some of our vitamin D rich foods. Then there's other people who are still eating a ton of vitamin D rich foods, but because of where they live in the world, need supplementation.
Interesting. You've taken that to a different level for me.
I tend to do that. I apologize.
No, that's very interesting. I've never heard that we are getting, I understand that there are different rays coming from the sun and different UV lights, I guess, not the rays, the UV levels. I understand that, but not that people who live amongst different, what did you call it? Meridians?
The latitudinal lines.
The latitude lines. I've never heard of that before, and that we have different levels of vitamin D.
It's pretty fascinating if you look at ancestral diets. You know, there's a big push for ancestral diets, but I don't believe there's one ancestral diet. I think your ancestral diet is different based off where you lived in the world through evolution. So people who lived above those higher latitudes, you see that their diets are higher in certain organ meats, certain food sources that they needed to get in order to survive at those places.
I hear a lot about the organ meats, especially through pregnancy. So what are your thoughts on detoxing our bodies? Could you tell us all about these bad detoxes? What's good? What's bad?
Yeah. So detox is, well, it's slightly controversial, right? And I just want to, you know, throw it out there that those quick, like liver detox protocols and stuff like that, I don't think they don't actually detox you, right? They're not chelating chemicals out of your body and pulling them through. That's just not how they work. They're supporting the systems, but your body has to do the detox on its own. And there's a lot of things that go into detoxing, but I think when I talk detox, it's more of like an environmental detox, detoxing the world around you, right? Limiting what you're exposing yourself to in chemicals is more important than doing some sort of liver cleanse or colon cleanse prior to pregnancy. We do see that the placenta accumulates different types of chemicals. And we do see that chemical exposure affects pregnancy outcomes, certain things. In fact, I have an entire blog post on this on the website. But we talk about different chemicals and their association with things like miscarriage and placental dysfunction, preeclampsia, intrauterine growth restriction, and a lot of these complications. Some of our biggest offenders are going to be things like BPA. Right? They're endocrine disrupting chemicals is what they are, right? Chemicals that mimic or affect the hormones in the body, and everything in pregnancy, conception, postpartum is all regulated by hormones. So if you're getting exposed to these endocrine disrupting hormones, it seems kind of common sense that then you're going to disrupt the hormones of pregnancy, right? So BPA, phthalates are another big one that we see being associated with things like placental dysfunction and miscarriage and those sorts of things. Other ones are organ tins. So it's the metal tin is also associated with some different changes, organophosphates, some different pesticides, you know, some of the old ones that you don't see in use anymore, but are in groundwater like DDT and some of these other chemicals, bromide-based chemicals, those affect thyroid function, and thyroid is huge in pregnancy. A lot of things, a lot of those chemicals. So it would be going through and looking at, you know, your water source. Do you have well water? Do you have city water? What kind of chemicals can you find in your water? Testing your water if you're worried about it can be important. Looking at your cleaning products, your skincare products, those sorts of things. Do I have endocrine disrupting chemicals that I'm being exposed to on a regular basis? If somebody is planning on consuming their placenta, that's also something that I have them think about throughout their pregnancy. Because the placenta harbors, and you can find high amounts of a lot of these chemicals in the placenta. It doesn't necessarily filter all of them and prevent your baby from getting them, because we see that babies are born with amniotic blood. You know, if we take the amniotic blood, there are pesticides already found in the fetal blood system, right? So we know the placenta doesn't filter everything, but it tends to accumulate in the placenta.
Right.
So if you're going to do placental consumption, make sure you're keeping it clean.
How can we best do that? I know, of course, plastics, you know, we want to switch things over to glass or metal, probably we're drinking out of. What in our environment, you speak about a lot of our environment, what is it that we can do in our homes and our environment to really make a difference?
Yeah. Things like, you know, a filter on your water, cleaning out as much stuff as you can. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Okay. Again, looking at the products that you're using on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Do they have parabens? Do they have phthalates in them? Are you using BPA containers? Anything like that. Teflon, cookware, those sorts of things are not
that's
that
a good
great.
One. Yeah. I think that's a good one. A lot of people don't realize as soon as you get, I don't think it's dangerous until as soon as you get a nick on it, right? Like one little nick, and it's leaching that into your food.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. It can be a yucky world out there. What about the EMFs and cell phones? And we hear a lot about that kind of pollution or toxins. Is there any way we can prevent ourselves from that exposure?
You know, it's a tough one. That's a tough one because it is around us all the time. You know, some people will say talking with headphones on versus putting the phone up to your ear, or even, you know, the wireless buds. Right. Some things will say that those put, you know, attract a lot of that, those radio frequencies and different things, but I don't have a good answer for that one.
It's all around us.
It is. It's all
the times we live in.
Yep. It's, you know, and oftentimes it's controlling what you can control so that the things you can't control don't affect you as much.
That's well said. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Because let's be honest, we're not going to be able to do 100%, right? We're never going to get back to where we were 10,000 years ago. And nor would we want to, really, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. Like there were some, we sometimes immortalize some of the things, right? Oh, they had they had it together, right? They were eating good and all the whole foods, and they were also dying at 40. So there's that, right? There's a lot of things that I think sometimes we immortalize what we don't know, and there's pros and cons to everything. And I talk, again, I have people I work with all over the world, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And it's one of the things that we try to remind moms of is do the best you can with what you have.
Right.
It's never going to be perfect, as any parent will tell you, right? Even once they get here, it's never going to be perfect. So you do the best you can with what you have. And nutrition is important. But if you live in a food desert, nutrition is going to be hard. And that's what we say, do the best with what you have. And when I work with patients, oftentimes we're doing that. What do you have? Let's work with it. They may not be able to get organic food nor afford it. And that's okay. I'd rather them eat the vegetables with the organophosphates on them than not eat the vegetables at all.
Absolutely. So good. So what do you believe is the absolute best thing a woman can do to prepare her body for labor and delivery? I think you touched on that earlier, that vitamin D will make it a little not so painful, but what else can we do?
Oh, there's so much. I have an entire chapter in my published book. So it's chapter 12 is functional childbirth. I'm also in my PDF giveaways. I'm giving away through the summit. I have an entire PDF book on functional childbirth, where we took chapter 12 and we made it bigger, because there's so much you can do to change your childbirth outcomes. A lot of the people mm-hmm. that I work with come to me because it's not their first time, and their first time kind of sucked. And they had rough mm-hmm. pregnancy experiences. They had complications, long labors, failure to progress, all those different things. And mm-hmm. when I ask them things like, oh, how did you prepare? Well, I started eating dates at 36 weeks. There's so much more, right? Nutritionally. And it's just, most people just don't know. Like even the mm-hmm. midwives don't know. Right. And one of the keys I try to tell people is that the preparation, nutritionally, hormonally, all of the above for labor and delivery starts way back in the second trimester. Mm. Right? Your cervix is already changing in preparation for labor, starting at like 24 weeks, 28 weeks, right? Right at the beginning of the third trimester. And it's all hormonally based. So, mm-hmm. and then we're supporting it with nutrition. Is really what we're doing. We're hugging the maternal physiology with nutrition. The signals that prepare maternal physiology for labor and delivery are signaled by the maturation of the baby themselves. So the fetal adrenal glands are about the size of kidneys when in the fetus. And the adrenal glands produce hormones that the placenta thus converts, and then these new hormones trigger different maternal physiological changes. The bigger baby gets, the more of these hormones we see in the maternal physiology, right? Everything peaks at about 32, 34 weeks, but it all starts way back when. And one of the first things that happens is we see a surge in a hormone called cortisol. Now, most of us hear cortisol, we think, ah, stress, right? Mm-hmm. But we see that cortisol does a number of different other functions in the body besides making us feel stressed. One of the big ones when we're looking at pregnancy is that it is the primary driver of cervical remodeling. Now, up until the point that we start to see cortisol levels rise, the fibers, the collagen fibers of the cervix are all wound together in a like braided ball that looks like a bird's nest. They're all tight. Right? We don't want that cervix to open. We want to knot that thing shut. Mm-hmm. As cortisol levels rise, we see that there is a change in the type of collagen fiber and the structure of the collagen fibers within the cervix. They become parallel. Now, they don't open, right? We're not looking for effacement at this phase. We're not looking for shortening of the cervix. Those are issues that we see. A lot of people will have that when they have progesterone deficiencies, right? Or things like vitamin C and vitamin E deficiencies can be associated with premature cervical remodeling.
Wow.
So this is a highly inflammatory process. There's a lot of inflammation that happens when we're unwinding and rewinding collagen fibers. And we have to be able to reduce that inflammation. And that's where vitamin C and vitamin E come in. They're antioxidants. They help to reduce that inflammation and they help to stabilize the structure of that collagen. That's the first step, right? In preparing your body for labor and delivery. If these fibers don't become parallel, they can't open, right? They're tied together. They're holding on. They're holding hands, right? They're not going to be able to let go. And we need cortisol to do that. The other thing that we start seeing elevated is estrogen levels. Estrogens stimulate the production of prostaglandins. If anybody has been induced, one of the things they use for induction is prostaglandins. And what prostaglandins do is they start to soften these newly paralleled fibers so that they have flexibility and movement in them. Okay, that's the next step. In order to do this, we need omega-6 fatty acids. We need inflammatory fats. Everything that goes into labor and delivery is an inflammatory process. We need inflammation to have a baby. Do we need too much? No, we need to balance that inflammation. Right? Too much, we go into labor too early. Right? Not enough, and we delay the onset of labor. Okay, so we have to have that element. There's thresholds too. So as we kind of stair step our way through those last months of pregnancy, we hit a threshold and it's like, bing, another light comes on in the maternal physiology and we start another pathway. The next pathway is the production of hyaluronic acid. Hyaluronic acid, most of us know from skin care creams, mm-hmm. right? It helps to fill in those fine lines and wrinkles that none of us want. And the way it does that is it suspends moisture in animation, meaning it suspends fluid between the cells, not in the cells, by plumping up the tissue, the collagen around there. Hyaluronic acid is found in skin and collagen, cartilage. It's a lubricant, okay? What we see is that at the onset of labor in the few weeks beforehand, there is a surge in hyaluronic acid production. But this only happens if we've made enough prostaglandins early enough, earlier in gestation. We have to hit a threshold. When we do that, we start to fill in the gaps between these newly parallel squishy fibers, and we start to see effacement, right? We see that cervix shortening. We see it opening up. We see it squishy, right? It's the squishy factor. That's when we can open up that cervix, right? But if we don't do all of that work way back in the second trimester, in the early third trimester, we're not going to reach that threshold until later on in gestation. You could have your baby pumping you full of all the signals, like, hey, mom, like, I'm getting mature. I want you to start changing that cervix so we can get out of here. But if you don't have certain nutrients on board, it's not going to happen. We also need hormones at play here. One of the big ones is thyroid hormone. Now, nobody talks about thyroid hormones in pregnancy, but we see new studies. We're talking studies from 2020, 2021, brand new stuff, talking about this subclinical hypothyroid pattern and things like delayed onset of labor, longer labors, more bleeding during labor, and other labor and delivery complications. And we need thyroid hormones in order to make certain things happen in the uterus in preparation for labor and delivery. And there's still not a ton of information as to exactly how, but we see that people who have elevated TSH levels in the third trimester have more labor and delivery complications. What goes into making our thyroid happy are nutrients like iodine, zinc, selenium, magnesium, vitamin D. There's a bunch of nutrients that we see helping support thyroid function. Interestingly, we see that these same vitamins and minerals are associated with changes in the progression towards labor and delivery and increased labor and delivery complications, such as things like prolonged labor and hemorrhaging.
Wow. Mind is blown right now. That was an incredible lesson. Do you have, when you have women coming to your, coming to you and they're planning on getting pregnant, do you have them initially upfront knowing whether they want a home birth or an, or at the hospital? And do you guide them one way or another? How do you make that decision, or how do women make that decision?
Yeah. My job is never to make decisions for my patients. My job is to give them the unbiased information that they need to make the decision that is best for them, right? Some people feel more comfortable in a hospital birth, and that's beautiful, right? Yay for them. My job is to support them so that they can reach that goal that they want in the situation that they feel most comfortable. Some people want to be a home birth, and I think that's beautiful too, right? Mm-hmm. My job is to support them to reach their goals of having that experience.
So how do you walk a woman through that? How do you guide her and give her the pros and cons of both, or walk us through it? What would that look like?
Yeah. So if I'm sitting down with somebody, obviously, you know, on my initial paperwork, I ask, what's your goals, right? What are your goals for this pregnancy? For most of the people I work with, they've had, like I said, kind of some bad experiences in the past that are guiding them one way or the other. So we talk about that experience. We go into detail about their previous experience. Number one, it helps me understand maybe what happened, knowing the maternal physiology, where the hiccup was, so that we can hopefully prevent that hiccup from happening again. We also talk about their supportive care scenario, right? Who did you have before? Did you have a midwife? Did you have an OB? Was it a home birth? Was it a hospital birth? How did you feel about that experience? What would you have changed about that experience? And then we talk options based off of that. Like, this is how you felt in that experience. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you didn't love it. Here are your other options. And here are people that I know, if depending on where they live, right, that you can interview and you can talk to. Maybe you'd do good with a doula. Maybe you wouldn't do good with a doula, right? Not everybody does good with that. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people. Like, I just get into my own head when I have a baby, and I don't care who's in the room. Like, it didn't even matter, right? So for me, having a doula was kind of not, I had one. But I was like, I don't know. I didn't even hear you. I'm sorry. Right. I did my own thing. So everybody's different. And it is kind of a little bit of a detective type scenario to figure out what's going to be best for that person, and not telling them what's going to be best, but also saying, based off what you told me, I want you to research this option. Okay. Here's some people you can talk to and make that decision. Whatever decision you think is best for your scenario is the decision that I support, right? I feel the same way oftentimes about dietary philosophy. So in my practice, it is not my job to change somebody's philosophy, right? Dietary philosophy is a lot like a religion for some people. And it's not my job to change that. Just like it's not my job to make somebody believe what I believe religiously. My job is to make them succeed at their goals with their beliefs, to guide them to that goal with whatever I need to, right? The information to make that happen. Sometimes like if vegan patients, right? That's kind of where I'm going with this. It's not my job to make them eat meat, right? It's my job to help them have the experience they're looking for with the limitations that their belief puts in place for them, right? Vegans, we know, are more likely to have certain nutritional deficiencies. Just like we know people who eat a standard American diet are more likely to have certain nutritional deficiencies, right? And we give them that information and say, hey, here's what I'm looking for. It's not that I have anything against you and your philosophy. It's just that the research shows that you are more likely to have an iron deficiency or a B12 deficiency. So we're going to watch that more closely, right? We are going to watch that with testing. And if we see anything, we're going to throw extra supplements at you because you don't want to eat meat, right? We will do what we can within your philosophy to make this happen.
That's beautiful. So is there anything else that you think women should be tested for or know about her body prior to conceiving?
Oh, so many things. And that depends on their presentation. I think there are certain things that definitely help us look at the physiology to know what some of our hiccups might be. Some of the things that I highly recommend getting baselines of would be things like vitamin D. I like to see what progesterone levels are, right? We usually do that on day 21 of our menstrual cycle or 7 days post ovulation if you have longer or shorter cycles. If they have irregular cycles, that becomes important, right? If they have certain patterns to their menstrual cycles, checking those hormones do become important. If somebody is showing signs of cortisol dysregulation issues, sometimes looking at that cortisol pattern and knowing what we're getting into prior to pregnancy can become important. Most people don't realize that there is a 500% increase in the production of cortisol throughout pregnancy. That's huge, right? And if you are coming into pregnancy with adrenal issues, excessive stress, whether it's physical or emotional, that is going to affect your pregnancy and postpartum experience. Your recovery from pregnancy is going to suck. If you came into that already low and we just zapped your adrenals more.
Right.
Right. So that's something that's, you know, if somebody's looking for that whole experience, right? We're usually going off of symptomology and stuff like that, but that's something we oftentimes will recommend looking at. Other things we tend to look at are B vitamins. Not everybody needs to be on a methylated B vitamin supplement.
Right.
I see people who don't need that. And what they're doing is they are over methylating and they are causing dysfunction in their body by taking methylated B vitamins. There is really only a small group that really need to be taking those, in my opinion. Okay. And determining whether or not you are one of those can be as simple as a little blood test. Right. So sometimes we'll do that. We'll look at things like homocysteine levels, right? There's a whole list of things that we can look for. And it is very much dependent on the individual, but those are kind of some of the things that we kind of look at. You can get a lot of information from your basic CBC metabolic lipid panels. Anytime I have somebody come in, I want to see the basics they had to run with their PCP, because maybe that's all we have to do based off of their history of menstrual cycles, based off those basic labs. That's all. We just kind of set them up for success on a basic level. Again, if somebody's coming in with a history of recurrent miscarriage, they have preeclampsia on a previous pregnancy, we're going to dive in a little deeper. We're going to do more testing.
You are the queen of nutrition around pregnancy. You absolutely know it all. You touched on in your own pregnancy, you got in your head. Is there anything mental that we should know, and what kind of mental space we should go into pregnancy or even labor and delivery with?
Yeah, I think there is, for me, and I guess everybody's different, right? Some people don't do good knowing what's going to happen in their body, right? They trust the experience. The more they know, the more it causes fear and anxiety.
Right.
For me, I'm the opposite. One of the reasons that I dove into this line of work, because it gave me peace in my pregnancy, right? I went into pregnancy going, oh no, I don't really know much about this. I should I should really learn about this because this is about to happen. And and when I went into my birth experience, I went into it like a boss, like in my own mind. I was like, got this. Like, I think I know what's going to happen. I know all the stages of labor. I've done research on nutrition. Like, I feel confident in my experience. And I think it's whatever gives the expectant mom confidence, but also a reality, right? And one of the sections of my book is called The Illusion of Control. Because we can do all of these amazing things and set the body up for functional success and still have a negative childbirth outcome, right? Because there are things that are not in our control. And the goal of functional medicine is to give a woman the best experience she can with what she's been given, right? And with what she's been given, as it goes back oftentimes three generations, right? In every pregnancy, there are three generations at play.
Wow.
Which is fascinating, isn't it?
That is.
And with that in mind, our goal is to support the natural maternal physiology and to hug that physiology as best we can, with the understanding that there may still be something that pops up that is out of our control. You know, fetal positioning. That's something we try to control. We do spinning babies. We do all sorts of things. But sometimes those little ones just come down in a bad angle. And that sucks. It really does, right? My second was an OP baby. And I tell you what, that experience was so much different than my first. I remember my first birth being so empowered, going, oh my God, I actually loved labor. I left that experience going, I kind of want to do it again. Like, that was so much fun. And I was joking with my husband. I was like, we should have like five kids. Like, I just want to be pregnant all the time. That was so amazing. And then there was my second and my second birth. And I remember joking as soon as she was born that if he could go down the hallway and get a vasectomy, like, can we just do that all in the same day? Can we do that? Is that good? Because I was done.
What exactly is, I know what breech is. What is, can you explain that?
OP is like sunny side up.
Okay.
Is what we call it too. So typically with babies, they're facing the rectum when they come out and then they twist on the way out. Yep. She was facing my pubic bone. She looked like she got into a fight with Mike Tyson when she was out. It was kind of sad. Yeah. She was bruised all over her face. Her eye, the whites of her eyes were red, things like that. It's rough for everybody, but it was a completely different experience where it was just, you know, a little more trauma, a little more, you know, it's just different. Right. And those are things that are out of our control to some degree, right? There was an old doctor back in the 1930s. Her name was Kathleen Vaughn, and I quote her in my book, but she wrote another book called Safe Childbirth. And one of the things that she noticed at the time, and she was right up there with Dr. Weston Price. I don't know if you're familiar with the Weston Price Foundation. She was one of his colleagues. And her thing was basically doing what Weston Price did and looking at these indigenous traditional societies, but looking at their birth practices and how the change in nutrition and the indoctrination of civilized foods changed their ability to birth. And one of the things that she found, one of the things she talks about a lot in her books, is that the most important time in female development is birth through puberty. And what a female child ate and was exposed to in that birth through puberty phase was more indicative of her ability to birth later than anything she did after puberty.
Whoa.
So that being said, sometimes women who come into the office, we talk a lot about childhood.
Yeah.
What was your childhood diet like? What was your mother's birth experience like? Because some of those things affect her ability to birth now.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's that illusion of control. We can't change. Yeah,
right.
We can't change that. All we can do is set her up for the best pregnancy and childbirth and postpartum success we can with what she's been given.
Right. That's extraordinary. Awesome. Well, you are giving away your PDF bundle. Is that right?
I
could you tell us a little bit more about that?
So I am giving away all three of my books for free. in PDF form. So we have my published book, which is Functional Maternity. And it is, again, the first book to kind of pull the functional medicine and nutrition side into maternal physiology and that pregnancy experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I've got that PDF. It's on sale through Amazon for $30. You get it for free, PDF. The other two I have are my eBooks. I have Functional Fertility, which is my improving egg and sperm quality for better conception and pregnancy success. And then I have Functional Childbirth, which is basically taking chapter 12 from my Functional Maternity book and expanding it. And it's a patient's guide to preparing nutritionally for labor and delivery. So all three of those are available through the summit.
And there is a password to that.
There is. So you want that password for listening for today. So it is all lowercase, one word, Healthy Pregnancy Revolution.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you today, Sarah.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie. And I am always open for conversation. So if anybody out there has questions, wants to talk, feel free to reach out to me through the Functional Maternity website or at functional.maternity on social media.
And we have all those links on the page you are listening to here below. Thank you.
Thank you.